happy Spotify Wrapped season to all who celebrate.
Happy Spotify Wrapped season. Honestly, I keep bringing it up in like every social setting this week. And then I'm like, am I boring just listing my five top artists to people and letting them judge me on it?
Mine are always a bit boring because I have to listen to music to write.
Mm.
So it's not my favorite music. It's whatever I was like hyper fixating on at the time I needed to write something, you know?
That's exactly what mine is too. But my hyper fixation songs tend to be like...
Wait, are you going to... No, go on. I was going to say, are you going to tell me something extremely Christy? Like what is your top... What are your top Spotify Wrapped songs?
Okay, so my top artist, which will be unsurprising for people listening to the podcast, is Kim Petras, who does the intro and outro song.
Fantastic.
So I had three Kim Petras songs in my top 10. And then my number three song, Emma, was another hyperfixation moment from the summer. My number three song was Chrissy Wake Up, the TikTok remix iconic from Stranger Things. I also found the Daily Moods hilarious.
Oh my god, wait, that's the thing I wanted to tell you about.
Mine somehow are just like basically based on my Halloween playlist that I listen to 90% of the year, that's 6 hours long. So my mood for the morning is Golden Hour Feel Good Spooky. Which, sure.
I think Feel Good Spooky is the brand of this pod.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And then my evening is Nostalgia Cottagecore Pumpkin Spice. And I'm like, okay, so that's still my Halloween playlist.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Drawing Blood. I'm Emma Merkling.
And I'm Christy Slobogan.
And today's episode is all about the 2021 film Old by American blockbuster filmmaker M. Night Shyamalan.
Based on a graphic novel called Sandcastle by Pierre-Oscar Levy and Frederick Peters.
And we're going to be talking about the history of disability and horror and the representation in general of disability in art, media, and broader culture. We'll be drawing a lot and talking about critical disability studies and crip theory. And we'll also be talking about the history of largely non-consensual medical testing and eugenics. So needless to say, this episode has a lot of content warnings. Really, we do discuss some genuinely very upsetting stuff. So content warning for discussions of eugenics, including narcissism, body horror, murder, but also and above all, harmful portrayals of and language surrounding disability.
We've touched on all of these topics before, but representations of disability really comes to a head in this film, Old.
And Old, for those who aren't familiar, is a horror film about aging and about disability, where basically this group of people, against their will and without knowledge of it, gets sent to this island where time speeds up, so they age rapidly, and those with degenerative conditions see the effects of that in the span of 1 or 2 days. And then there's a big twist relating to Big Pharma and the medical industrial complex. So there's all themes that we'll be touching on. Yeah, so let's get into it.
So yeah, today we're talking about M. Night Shyamalan's 2021 film, Old, which I became obsessed with just from seeing the adverts in the tube stations when I lived in London last year. You're looking down at a woman on the beach and you just see her like wide-brimmed hat and it looks really idyllic until you realize that half of her is aging and then becoming a skeleton. So it's like, ooh, spooky, spooky. I saw the film and then Emma, you watched it this week and you were texting me about it. So I do want to hear from the outset what you think, but I'll just say first, I saw the film, had some major, major issues with some of the characters and the way that they were depicted, which will definitely be a big part of our episode today. But I think I'm just a sucker for these types of like suspense horror films. And so I was just so engrossed in like the premise, and it's such a fast-paced film.
Yeah.
Once you get to the meat, okay, well, we can disagree about that, but once you get to the meat of the premise, I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen next? Like, it's very mysterious, but I will say, watching it a second time this week, there are some clunkers of dialogue and plot. So, Emma, would you like to share how you felt about this film?
So, behind the scenes, we had a mild crisis at the beginning of this week because I watched the film. Christie's wanted to do this episode for ages and watched the film when it came out, so last year.
Yeah.
And I only watched it recently, and we had a bit of a crisis on, was it Sunday? Because I texted you being like, Christy, this is like the worst film I've ever seen. This film is so bad. I don't have anything to say about this.
Bit of a crisis, but it was
well,
okay.
Well, we've decided that, firstly, here we are disagreeing, which is fun. Secondly, there's a lot of interesting stuff to say about the themes that it brings up. I just don't think that it is interesting on those themes, which is interesting. Like, we'll get to this. Because, you know, I also love suspense horror. I just think this is bad horror. And I think probably we have to talk a little bit about the plot and stuff before I can say why. But my overall take on this film is like, the writing, bad. The acting, bad. The cinematography, fine. The pace, fucking boring, bad.
I totally disagree.
I know, which is wild. But it's like, So Shyamalan's known for his twists, right?
Yeah.
I knew what the twist was.
You did?
Yeah, once they were on the beach, I was like, oh. Like, or once stuff started happening to them, but I already knew that was going to happen because of the posters. So
it is very ham-fisted, like hit you over the head with the symbolism. Yeah.
Yeah, basically my prep for this episode was watching 8 different M. Night Shyamalan films or something.
Wait, didn't you count?
No. Maybe it was four. I'm exaggerating.
Jesus.
I'm exaggerating. I watched Old, I watched Unbreakable, Signs, and Split, I think. Maybe 4.
I really want to watch the other ones, and I want to hear what you think of the other ones.
Well, so what came out of it for me, which was interesting, was the other films were better, I think, than Old. But a theme that comes through in all of them is a really harmful and classic take on disability.
For sure.
It's a trope that comes up again and again and again in his films. There's this blog called Crip Scholar, and the person who writes that like outlined, that's the first place where I saw this sort of listed out like this.
That's a really good piece for understanding the director's framing of this and why it's so problematic. But those are some of the main themes that we'll be touching on in this film, whether it's good or not. But I did just want to say, Old is still one of the M. Night films that has gotten better mixed reviews in recent years. It has 50% on Rotten Tomatoes, Old does. So it's like as straight down the middle as you can get, whereas The Happening has 17%.
Yes, well.
And The Village has 43%, whereas Split, which we also both watched this week, has 78%.
Yeah.
And I do agree that that's a more compelling film in terms of how the film is made and packaged. And
definitely. And I want to clarify that, because like we'll get into it, but you know, what I meant by good, because, you know, there's one school of thought that's like, how can a film be good if it has these harmful portrayals of like,
of course,
you know, disability and other things as well. But what I meant by that was, I think the pacing was better. I thought the acting was better. I thought there was less explanation. I thought there were moments that were genuinely suspenseful and scary, you know, and Split's kind of a good example, because I actually think McAvoy did a really good job as an actor, despite the fact that the very concept and portrayal itself are an issue.
Okay, so I think that's good setup for like what the main themes will be of this episode, how we're going to relate it to a couple of other pieces of visual culture. This is much more like the history of medicine and disability studies side of things rather than history of science or the occult like the last two episodes have been.
Yeah.
Let's go through a little bit of what the plot of this film is. And as we said, M. Night Shyamalan is kind of there's this like film scholar, Jeffrey Andrew Weinstock, who's like, from the outset of his book about critical approaches to M. Night Shyamalan, he's like, yeah, he's definitely a one-trick pony.
No, I love that that's a book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I've got it right here. And so the trick is one that worked really well in The Sixth Sense, which I think is 1999, because people didn't know that M. Night Shyamalan was going to do these massive reveals, big twists.
And I guess we should say off the top, right? That's what he's known for.
Yes.
Written and directed by M. Night Shyamalan is a byword for there's a twist ending.
But now it's become this thing where you're watching an M. Night Shyamalan film and you're like, okay, what's the big twist going to be? diminishing returns with every film.
Yeah. But what I've realized about that is, like, for me, really good horror, like we saw with Midsommar, for instance, is good because it's written by, let's say, often by like outsider groups to criticize and explore structures of power, like societal structures of power that domineer our lives. To take one from the, is it late 18th or early 19th century, Anne Radcliffe's Mysteries of Udolpho, I think is hers, which is, you know, sort of about marriage and like contracting women into marriage and that is a societal ill, all the way to Jordan Peele, you know, and films like Get Out, which are written to critique, you know, the relationship between white and black people in America, white-black power dynamics. What makes horror like Midsommar or Get Out, for instance, good is that the allegory works on many levels. Because, you know, there's the story on the one hand, and what makes it so good is all the things that are not said, and that this richness, you know, that there's like an excess of information that's not spelled out, of things that happen that aren't explained. And that's not only contributing to building suspense, but it's also meaning that, you know, like we talked about in Midsommar, it's a film about capitalism. It's a film about white supremacy. It's a film about nationalism. It's a film about bad boyfriends. It's a film about relationships. And the problem with things like Old for me and a lot of Shyamalan's films in general is they are what they say on the tin. This is a film where the horror is about aging. It's not about anything else. You know, like there are other aspects that play into it,
right?
But is it even an allegory? You know, like maybe that's just a personal preference, but yeah.
It's true that everything is spelled out. So that's a good segue actually to get into the beginning of the plot, because watching it a second time, the first like 30 minutes, everything that every character says hints at what's about to happen to them.
Like, I think hints is a generous word.
You're right. And I will also say that this question of good horror, bad horror, maybe the reason that one of the reasons that I enjoyed this film a bit more than you did, is that I like it when my horror has a bit of the, not necessarily the absurd, but just like a bit of the ridiculous to it, a little bit of humor, a little bit of clunky, stupid absurdity. Maybe one of the reasons I like Old is because there's so many clunkers in it where you're like, oh my God, like that did not just happen. Like, I like when something scary or unsettling is happening and I just bark laugh at the TV.
But what's interesting is I don't think it's camp, which is a form of quote unquote bad horror that I can also get behind. Where it's, because camp is also sort of making fun of itself, right?
Absolutely,
but I think the problem here, or what you're saying you enjoy and what I don't necessarily enjoy, is a film that isn't laughing at itself.
So let's kind of think about that as we're rocketing through the plot. So the film kind of opens on this resort, this family, the Kappa family, which are the core group, really. And they are going to this very kind of White Lotus-esque resort. We know it's on an island, but they don't specify where in the world it is. And everyone's accents are kind of all over the place. So the Kappa family is very much the focus when they arrive at this resort. Gorgeous beach, jungle, rich people. And even if you don't know the actual plot of the film, but right when it opens, you've got the little girl singing in the van on the way to the hotel. And the mom goes, "You have such a beautiful voice. I can't wait to hear it when you're older."
Which is such a weird thing to say. Has anyone ever said that?
No. And so, you know, even if you've just seen the poster in the advertisements, you're like, well, she's going to get older.
You're like, dun, dun, dun.
It's called Old. Like, anyway, everything at the beginning is referencing time, referencing aging. But the dad picks up this flyer in their hotel room. Oh, Warren and Warren, the pharmaceutical company. We love them at work. He was like, oh, the hotel room must have some partnership with this pharmaceutical company. And once again, it's Shyamalan hitting you over the head with foreshadowing.
Well, that's why I was like, it's one of the reasons I was like, oh, I know what the twist is. You know what I'm saying? Like,
the kids, even at the beginning, once again, hinting at the fact that they're going to get old in this film, especially the little boy, Trent, a lot of his mannerisms are very adult. You know, he'll go around and ask people like, what are your names and what do you do for a living? We find out that the parents, Prisca and Guy, are in the process of separating. And this is like the last vacation for their kids. And one of the things that Guy brings up is he's like, oh, but Prisca, what about the tumor? Like, does that change anything? And she's like, Guy, it doesn't change anything. We're already on the road to separation. That's the first hint that you get that there's a medical aspect to this, that someone is sick.
Yeah.
So then we start to meet other characters, and the Kappa family is offered by the guy who runs the hotel. He offers to drive them to a very special beach, like very secluded. It'll be a great memory for the family. You guys should totally do it. And so they get in the van with this other family, which is also has its share of problems, even from the couple of seconds that we see of them. And we get another hint at someone being sick in this group when Crystal, thin, blonde, Instagram model type situation, Crystal says to the waiter, like, I have a calcium deficiency.
And I thought it was interesting also from the start that there's like a good and a bad family who end up on this island. One is this very nuclear, heteronormative, I don't know, like quote unquote normal, I guess. I'm sure we'll talk about normality, you know, whether it's like young mother, young father, both with professional careers, and these two kids who are very like precocious and smart and sweet. And then the other family where it's like this younger, much quote unquote hotter woman, the partner of this much, much older man who's there with his mother. And there's like already a weird tension in that family and that dynamic. And she's painted as like, despite the fact that she's asking about the calcium thing because of her health, she's painted as superficial.
Yes.
You know, she's not like, hey, I'd like to order something with calcium because I have a calcium deficiency.
She's definitely caring about it. So the husband is played by Rufus Sewell in the quote unquote bad family. And you can't see him in a film and not think that he's going to be the villain. And I love him, but it's just like, ooh, okay, that is helping to code that family as bad.
Yeah.
And they have a little girl named Kara, and the husband, Charles, his mother also brought a dog. Also, there's another couple at breakfast, which is where all this is taking place. And a woman has an epileptic seizure. And so once again, that's another hint at chronic illness. Yeah. So M. Night Shyamalan is the guy driving the van to take them to this beach. And they get to the beach and there's already someone there. This is one of the more ridiculous things, I thought.
Ridiculous and a kind of racist.
Oh, no, for sure.
No?
For sure. They see this guy on the beach, this pretty tall, pretty large, like black guy. And
he's coded very like cool and hot. Like, I don't.
And yeah, know. Cool, hot, and like mysterious and quiet. But the girl in the Kappa family, Maddox, she sees him and she's like trying to be hip and cool and older. She's like, oh my God, that's mid-sized sedan. Wait, the rapper.
Can I just say, I was about to be like, that's Kasi Tedros because I couldn't remember.
His hit song, apparently, according to the little girl, is More Dough for the Cooking. And it's just like, what the fuck are you trying to do? And it's not successful. And it just comes off as really, really misplaced.
Yeah. And uncomfortable, frankly.
Yeah. It was very strange. Anyway, so he's there on the beach.
It's very boomer. It's like making fun of like, oh, rap artists have such weird names.
Yes, exactly.
But then you don't go the route of like some of the genuinely fantastic, quote unquote, weird names that rappers choose. But like this weird white ass, like mid-sized sedan. And it's like, is that the joke? I don't, if it is, it doesn't land. And also his character in general, as we'll get to, is nothing. Like it's not just that he has no substance, which he doesn't, but also that like there's no need for him in the story. And then there's this, once again, we have the good family, the bad family. And then it feels like by the same token, the racially mixed family, you know, that's like this couple where the husband is an Asian nurse, I think.
Yep.
And the wife is a black therapist, I think.
Yep.
And they're like completely two-dimensional. But then again, so is almost everyone in the film. But all the characters of color get way less screen time.
And this is when things start happening. They find this woman's body. I thought it was actually a really good jump scare. Like the little boy is in the water and then this woman's body bumps up against him. So we
know, that was like, a good jump scare.
Yeah. Okay, we're like, okay, the horror is starting, right? And so that starts happening. Then the husband in the bad family's mother starts wheezing. The explanation is, oh, she was just so in shock from the corpse that they found. She starts dying, then she dies. And then things start to go wrong with the kids as well, where the kids start complaining that their swimsuits are too tight. It's very drawn out, even as obvious as the premise of the film is just from the adverts. Reading one sentence of a synopsis or watching a trailer. M. Night Shyamalan really draws out the reveal.
But also something I don't think you mentioned was the reason Kasi Tedros, mid-sized sedan, is on the beach. He's there with this woman and she goes into the water naked. And then that's the body that washes up initially. And then he explains to the group that he's there because he and she have the same, what was it?
It wasn't that they have the same disease, it's just that they're both sick. She had MS, and he, I believe, has hemophilia, but I don't know if it's spelled out.
Okay.
He has a problem that means that his nose is constantly bleeding throughout the film.
Yeah.
But yeah, so things start going wrong. The kids are talking to the Black therapist and the Asian nurse couple, and they're doing the, what are your names and what are your professions? And then the nurse, Jaren, is like, oh, let me guess your ages, which is once again hitting you over the head with it. Jesus. And so they're like, what are your ages? And of course, he ends up guessing like 5 years more than the kids actually are. They're supposed to be like 5 and 9 or something. And he guesses 11 and 16. And that's when the mom comes up and she doesn't recognize these kids.
Which is also wild.
Which is also wild. I'm like, okay.
And also the adults have not changed at all. And the premise, no, they haven't. The thing for that is like, oh, well, adults don't look as different as they age. And it's like 7 years, because I think it's 7, right? 7 years, I look very different than I did at 22. I'll tell you that for free.
Yeah. No, it is. Yeah, there's a little bit of, or a lot of suspension of disbelief here. But so that's the big reveal. It's like, oh my God, the actors for the kids have been replaced. They're like 6, 7 years older. That's why their swimsuits aren't fitting anymore, because they are bigger. They've aged. They're getting old. Yeah. So then Prisca, the mother, is like, oh my God, something's going on with my children. And so she brings them to the doctor, Charles.
So to clarify, the doctor is the guy who we mentioned. What did you say the actor's name was?
Rufus Sewell. The character's name is Charles. And so yeah, he's the dad in the quote unquote bad family. So she tries to get him to say what might be going wrong with her kids. And right after that, he kind of shatters this idea that doctors are reliable or like people to trust, because he then goes and has a paranoid episode where he thinks that mid-sized sedan is going to hurt him, and he just slashes him with a knife across the face.
Yeah.
And so that hints that like doctors can't be trusted. And of course, then the cut on mid-sized sedan's face heals almost immediately. And yeah, they explicitly say half an hour equals 1 year of our life. And
okay.
Like, oh, yes. Good. I'm glad I have the math for that. That's really helpful. Because then it allows you to think through all the inconsistencies, because M. Night Shyamalan gives you the formula for it.
I was also just going to say, it's also worth saying that they can't get off this beach, because as they try to pass, there's something going on, something electromagnetic. They black out when they try to leave the beach. And it's eventually they theorize it's because they're aging so fast that they're living in a different strand of time to what is outside this rock wall that encloses the beach. And so it's like that, what's it called? Divers?
They liken it to the bends when you come up to the bends fast when you're scuba diving.
So that's, they can never, they can't get off.
Another big medical thing happens, which I really loved, actually, the surgery scene where Prisca's tumor is getting bigger and bigger. And then they realize that the skin heals really quickly. So Charles, the doctor, cuts it open, and her husband has to hold up, open her abdomen while they take out this massive tumor. And then she automatically heals and then is fine again, which was like a really cool scene, I thought.
Yeah. They had to put their fingers in her wound to like hold it open, and the tumor keeps growing. So it just goes from being like a golf ball to like a...
That was another clunker where they kept being like, it's the size of a golf ball. It's the size of a softball. It's the size of a cannonball now. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, we get it. I get it. It's getting bigger. We understand the premise of the film now. So like, you can say that once, that it's getting bigger, and then we'll get it. And then we'll see it literally come out of her body as the size of like a human head. But so Charles is... mental, we don't actually know what's going on with this doctor. You know, he was paranoid and attacked mid-sized sedan. He's like, every once in a while he'll be doing a serious thing, like when he was doing the surgery, and he'll say, oh, but this is important. I need to ask a question. What film was it that Jack Nicholson and Marlon Brando were in? So it's first of all, like a really, you know, and I'm using this word in the sense of this is what it feels like M. Night Shyamalan is doing, but he's showing like going crazy in a very specific, particularly coded way. And it's also that, once again, scare quotes, going crazy is coded in violence.
Yeah.
He becomes a villain who's threatening people on the beach.
And that it's weirdly, the violence is linked to aging. And that's obviously a theme for the film as a whole. But it's a specific choice to use aging as the scaffolding on which to build that fear. And it means that we are associating the fear of aging, which is a common trope in horror films, with this fear of things becoming debilitating. And I think the reason for that, and the reason the two are yoked together, is because it's necessary. And this also gets into some disability theory stuff. I feel like it's necessary to make us care about the characters, because like, why would we care if they were quote unquote just people with debilitating illnesses that the imagined we of the audience don't have? Do you know what I mean? Whereas aging is a thing that affects us all. And I don't think it's a coincidence that in horror films are populated by aged crones, and I use that gendered word deliberately, witches and, you know, even vampires, and that either they're just like straightforwardly coded with this like fear of the female, like women ugliness, because women have to be young and beautiful, of course, which is another theme we'll get to shortly, I'm sure, with Crystal. You know, either they're just witches inherently scary for being women who don't need men, who have aged past their reproductive capabilities, you know, who create this magic that doesn't rely on the social order of the male dominated capitalist world we live in, or they have to sacrifice something to achieve immortality, which is the same thing in a flipped way, right? So vampires have to drink blood. It works because we all get old. That aging, like death, is one of these universal fears, and it shows up some of our societal fears and constructions of disability, because in both cases, like, yes, they have these debilitating, or in all of the cases, I think, they all have these disabilities or illnesses that regress over time. But the reason it matters that they regress over time is not just because of the twist, which will eventually be explained, but also because I think one of the implications is one of the reasons we fear aging is because we fear becoming infirm. We live in a society in which being infirm, becoming disabled, is like one of the worst things that can happen to you. And of course, the whole field of disability studies is pushing against that.
Okay, so that gets us perfectly into Crystal, who I think, and I think you'll agree with me, Crystal is kind of like the fulcrum of the film. I think her death, like we've had steady deaths up to now. The nurse has died. I think at this point, the therapist has died. The daughter's died. The whole Kappa family is still intact. But it is Crystal's death that makes it very abundantly clear the problems that M. Night Shyamalan has with chronic illness and disability. And I think one of the most helpful things that I read about this was the White Pube's review of this film. Mm-hmm. Gabrielle Della Puente is one of the members of the White Pube art critic duo, but they've been doing more critiques of general culture. So like they'll do video games, films. And for those who don't know, the White Pube is a name based on the White Cube Gallery in London. And so I thought it was interesting, like that Crystal and Charles, this married couple that you said was a little bit mismatched, you know, she's very young and beautiful, he's a lot older and obviously has a lot of money as a surgeon, is that their aging and their deaths are two of the most gruesome. So he dies of breast poisoning when he's slashed with a rusty knife, and she dies after she's roaming the beach as this, as you said, kind hag. Of like a crone, like a, yeah, hag, but like an Instagram model hag. Like she's got this makeup streaming down her face. She becomes humpbacked. And so this is once again, you know, the calcium deficiency that she has. Yeah. So we know it's something with her bones. The contrast with Charles is that their illnesses, their disabling illnesses, he's coded as evil and she's coded as vain. And those two things are like seen as really negative traits. So they become the villains, the monsters in this film. Evil is the worst thing that a man can be. And vain is the worst thing that a woman can be.
And also the various disabilities they have, because one attacks the body, because being a woman is all about the body, and one attacks the mind, because being a man is all about the mind.
But okay, so what happens with Crystal? This is the moment where, and I'm going to read really quickly from the White Pube's review. And I will say that this review is written from the perspective of someone who has a chronic illness. And so throughout watching this film, the White Pube writer is kind of realizing, like becoming increasingly uncomfortable with the way that chronic illness and disability are portrayed. And so they say with this moment, with Crystal's death, they write, everything had just been a slow-paced mystery up until that point, polite even. Suddenly, it was like the film felt free, released, and excited to finally cash in on the horror of sickness and disability with explicit force. Mm. Now, I do think that, you know, that freeness with the horror of sickness leaks out earlier, but this is really the moment where it's like body horror. So do you want to explain what happens with Crystal?
In my memory, she's chasing down two of the kids, and as she squeezes through this narrow cave, she begins to break the bones in her body, and because time is so fast, they set really fast as broken. And so she becomes this like mangled, completely non-human. I mean, it's her body's breaking in ways it's impossible for the body to break. You know, she looks like a, I was going to say a Rubik's cube, but that's a square.
No, but it's, what it's am I almost thinking like of?
Like a puzzle, like one of, you know, like a,
Or you know how dead spiders like
yes.
curl up on themselves? That's kind of what she looked like at the end, because each arm had like 16 breaks in it.
Yeah.
And she's glaring up at these kids, although they're not really kids anymore. And makeup is caked on, streaming down her face. And once again, it's just like, I mean, it is horror.
It is horror. Well, it's horrifying.
Yeah.
You know, it speaks to our most basic body horror fears, right? About something going wrong with the body. But there's a difference between films which deal with the horror of being in a body, which is something we all experience, no matter whether you are a person with disabilities or an able-bodied person, to something which turns disability itself into a site of horror. I think that's a significant difference. It's not the yes. same. Yeah.
It's not the same. And it's turning it into a spectacle as well. You know, the film is overexposing it for that shock value for horror.
And I think it's worth noting at this point that there's a long history of people with disabilities being used this way, or in fact, because it's not usually acted by people with disabilities, disability itself being used in this way and performed in this way, not just in horror films, but across the spectrum of films. And it's something that people talk about a lot in disability studies. I mean, in Paul Longmuir's book, Screening Stereotypes, Images of Disabled People in Television and Motion Pictures, you know, there's this idea that there are three stereotypes that are perpetuated like pretty universally across various media. One is disability as a punishment for evil. One is disability, or like people with disabilities are embittered by the fate that has befallen them and turned evil by it.
Yeah.
And then this idea that related to that, people with disabilities hate the world and they hate quote unquote normality and they want to destroy it. And I'm not just bringing that up sort of out of nowhere, because in other films by M. Night Shyamalan, like Unbreakable, which I want to mention briefly, and also Split, that is a key part of the story. So even if you could watch this film and be like, okay, well, maybe it's more about the fear of aging and other things that we'll get to with a twist, but yeah, it's got some harmful portrayal of disability. I think where I lose the benefit of the doubt for him is films like Unbreakable and Split, where disability, fear of it, hatred of it is like the plot of the film.
So Unbreakable is the one with Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson, correct?
Yeah, so Unbreakable is considered one of his best films. And I will say, like, in terms of like the pacing and the acting, it was more enjoyable. And it does something with disability that could have been done interestingly, I think. But I say that very cautiously and I will explain myself. So Unbreakable is about this character, Samuel L. Jackson, who's called Mr. Glass because he has a physical disability, osteogenesis imperfecta, which they introduce in the least kind way possible, which is basically one of the first scenes is his mother gives birth to him. The doctor's like, what's wrong with him? Did you drop him? And his mother's sobbing. She's like, no, why? And he's like, all of his bones are broken. And it's like, oh my God, like just from the beginning. But basically what ends up happening is we follow two strands in the film. You know, there's the Samuel L. Jackson character. At one point, he uses a cane. Later on, he ends up using a wheelchair because he's quote unquote made of glass, essentially, that he has this disability that causes his bones to be really brittle. And the whole plot of the film breaks down to the fact that the ways in which it's interesting is it breaks the superhero structure down to its base element in a way that's actually kind of interesting, in which it says, basically, Mr. Glass, because he has this disability, knows or assumes that since he is at one end of the spectrum of human development, there must be someone on the other end of the spectrum of human development who is super able-bodied. And that person in the film is Bruce Willis. And it says the quiet part out loud about superhero films, right? You know, Glass explicitly says, because I am disabled, I am a villain. And because you are super able-bodied, you are the superhero. That's how it works.
And I can see, and because I haven't seen this film, you saying that, I'm like, oh, that's such a good opportunity for critique. Is that what he's doing?
And it's like, sorry to break it to you, no. But yes, because it's breaking down that structure, it could have done something interesting with it. But instead, he is such a one-dimensional character. And we are so much more encouraged by the film to humanize Bruce Willis and see him as the good guy with his little nuclear family and the nuanced dynamics of that, which play out. And then ultimately, Mr. Glass gets locked up and sent to, and I quote, an institution for the criminally insane. Once again, this collapse of the physical onto the cognitive.
Yeah.
And in many ways, he collapses in one character, I think, in interesting ways. The tropes that Charles Riley in his book Disability and the Media calls the sad crip and the super crip. And I think I'm sure you have things to say about that. So maybe I'll just very quickly say what I mean by crip. It's a reclaimed term used in crip theory from an offensive word that was used to denigrate people with disabilities.
You can relate that to the way that queer has been reclaimed.
Yes. And in fact, and as Robert McCrea points out in his book, Crip Theory, queerness and disability have a lot in common. And his book brings the two disciplinary perspectives onto each other to look at how, first of all, this idea of coming out, which both groups and, of course, the people who straddle that intersection have to do constantly, coming out to your employer, coming out to people around you, but also because at its essence, both disability studies and queer studies have at their heart this idea of how societal norms determine what is considered normal versus what is considered abject. And a really important theme in disability studies is this fact, this distinction between the social approach to disability, which sees it as a construction that, you know, has been societally created by determining what is considered normal, by pushing people towards the able-bodied as the norm, that it's, you know, society is what disables, that disabled is not an inherent category that people have, but the way a society is structured and the way it approaches the issue of people having bodies that are different kinds of bodies versus the medical model.
I was going to say, part of society, of course, is culture. Films, books, comic books, whatever, like that is part of the social structures of how disability is understood, dealt with, and framed. And so, yeah, the social model of disability, which we can link to a couple other, Mike Oliver, Tom Shakespeare, there are some people who are writing about this, but I think the social model of disability is, as you said, you know, taking into account societal structures, but also taking into account lived experiences. You know, we talked a bit about race within old, and like, the intersection of that is not, the intersection of race and chronic illness is not dealt with at all in the film. But, you know, with the reading that I've done on the social model of disability, Old and then Split, which is the other M. Night Shyamalan film that I watched this week that I know you did too, they both definitely take the medicalized theory of disability rather than the social theory of disability. And the social theory of disability, the social model is not, there are issues with that as well. And there's been pushback and like, it's not a perfect model of thinking about disability, but it's a baseline. It's baseline. Yeah. And it does a lot of things that the medicalized model of thinking about disability does not.
Maybe it's just also worth saying explicitly that, as I understand it, the medical model of disability is the one that pervades in our culture, right? Which sees disability as an illness that has to be healed and fixed. And that relies on this key thing, which is basically what I think it's Tobin Sieber's. He says that, like, at its simplest, the ideology of ability is the preference for able-bodiedness. And that the way that modern culture, quote, feels the urgent need to perfect the body. And he says, whether medical scientists are working for the common cold or the elimination of all disease, a cure for cancer or the banishment of death, their preposterous and yet rarely questioned goal is to give everyone a perfect body. And like in cultural forms, this appears as this attempt to cure disability.
Yeah. Can I just say, Tobin Sieber's incredible scholar, and his book, Disability Aesthetics, is one of the first academic monographs that I read front to back.
That's such a high compliment.
No, it really is. And I love this book. And so I'll talk about that book in a minute. So one of the things that I think, like, thinking through and thinking with Tobin Sieber's and this social model of disability and against this medicalized model of disability, which both Old and Split do, is that
And Unbreakable.
Yeah. What M. Night Shyamalan is doing is that they are playing on these tired tropes of using disability as a shorthand for the ills of the world, like as a movie metaphor. You know what I mean?
And it works because disability is so often, as we've said, collapsed onto villainy and onto like moral ills.
Right. And so let me just real quick talk about how Split does this, just very, very briefly. And then I'll go back to Disability Aesthetics and Tobin Sieber's. Split is one of those films that has been written a lot by disability studies scholars, because in Split, the villain, played by James McAvoy, has dissociative identity disorder, which they call dissociative identity disorder in the film. But by using the term Split as the title of the movie, it harkens back to an old name for this condition, which was split personality disorder.
Yeah.
And which is problematic and like not what it's called anymore.
And in addition to that, I read an article or an essay that was also pointing out that, well, actually, I think it was in the comments of the article, but someone was like, I have dissociative identity disorder, and this is not remotely what it's like. You don't have these 23 separate personalities who like step into the limelight and like you completely transform and everyone notices and you're dressing differently and one of them is evil.
Exactly. So that's the plot of the movie, is that he's got all these different identities. You know, you mentioned the essay by Crippled Scholar from 2017, that Crippled Scholar says, quote, "To be mad is to be bad." And in the film Split, you know, this guy with dissociative identity disorder kidnaps these three women and is going to murder them or whatever. And he has this, as you said, one identity called the Beast that is truly evil.
Sorry, he has two identities that are evil.
Yeah.
And one identity that's non-human, which is the Beast.
Yes, that's it. That's the thing. The Beast is non-human. So the Beast is this identity that gives him this kind of super Crip identity, which M. Night Shyamalan does, and a lot of films do. Like, you see The Kingsman?
Yes, but I don't remember.
There's a evil woman who has this super Crip identity, but it's this conflation of super Crip and evil disability, where she is a double amputee, but her feet are swords.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's that kind of trope. But just like Charles's diagnosis of a mental illness in Old equated to violence and murder and evil, James McAvoy's diagnosis as having dissociative identity disorder equaled violence, murder, evil. So it's just like that really quick shorthand that is really lazy. We talked about this. I brought it up because a lot of the work that I do is on facial difference. And it's similar to the coding of facial scars and facial difference as evil.
And it contributes to this idea that cognitive disability and trauma and moral evilness and violence are somehow all the same thing or can be merged.
Right. Okay. So yeah, you represented like how these narratives are represented in fiction. So like Old, like Split, like Unbreakable. But I want to tie it back to art.
Boo.
Art, technically what we do. So Tobin Sieber's Disability Aesthetics, a really formative book for me, like thinking through representations of the body, chronic illness, people with disabilities, how they've been represented throughout art history, and how they're represented today by artists who identify as disabled and able-bodied artists, right? And so I wanted to think through how disability has been used, and it's used in Old and Split, some other M. Night Shyamalan films, where the disabled or injured body is used to convey flaws in the world or problems in the world. And Tobin Sieber argues that that's what modern art is. Modern art is perceived as disability, so it conceives of the disabled body and the disabled mind as important to the development of the capital M modern aesthetic.
That makes sense to me. That's like the surrealists.
Yes. Yeah. Surrealists are part of it. And then, you know, he's saying that disability was like a resource found, quote unquote, found by modern artists that they then embraced as one of their defining concepts. And I'm really paraphrasing here. So that's why, you know, modern art of the 20th century, it focuses a lot on psychological trauma, alienation, wounds, tortured flesh, a variety of human forms, twisted human forms. And where it really comes to a head, and what Sieber's talks about a lot, is the way that modern art was used by the Nazis.
I was about to say.
Yeah. Allowed them to put forward their eugenicist agenda, allows them to use modern art as a shorthand for sick.
Which, and once again, links to queerness.
Yes. Once again, links to queerness. Because if homosexuality is medicalized, pathologized, which it was.
And they called it, I was thinking specifically, they called it degenerate art. Degenerate being a term that it links disability and queerness.
Absolutely. And it also links to political degeneracy, but we're talking about physical degeneracy. Yeah. But so, yeah, so the Degenerate Art Exhibition happened in 1937. And this is where it all really came to a head, where Hitler and his culture minister put together this whole show that corralled all of these artworks that were termed as showing the wrong body, right? The non-perfect, non-Aryan. I mean, National Socialist art is horrible.
But also, it's obsessed. Fascist art in general is obsessed with the Übermensch. Think about the sculpture. They're like hard, like body armor as flesh, male body. Like, absolutely.
Yes. And so I will just do a little mini trigger warning here, but Hitler's speech to open the Degenerate Art Exhibition, I find that his speech is really helpful for understanding how pathologized the bodies within this art was. But he described the degenerate art, of course, every time we say degenerate art, it's like scare quotes and capitalized and everything, like for this particular historical moment. But he described this art as having, quote, deformed cripples and cretins, women who inspire only disgust, men who are more like wild beasts, children who, if they were alive, would be regarded as God's curse. The people that he is describing in really horrible ways are the people who become the targets of the eugenics program of the Nazis, but also were the targets of eugenics, which happened all over the Western world before this. But Siebers says, actually, Hitler was right here, and modern art does represent disability. That's his disability aesthetics that he's talking about. And I'll quote him. He says, if modern art has had such enormous success, it is because of the embrace of disability as a distinct version of the beautiful. In the late 20th century, with Rudy Giuliani, who's now much maligned, but when he was mayor of New York City and the Saatchi show of the young British artist Sensation came to New York, he was so outraged by like what this contemporary art was doing, and he called it sick, like explicitly. That was the word that he used. So once again, the language of eugenicist Nazi Germany is being repurposed in late 20th century America in the same way that codes art that is different or challenging or very, very modern as sick, disabled, wrong.
Can I also just say it's really interesting, I don't know if we're going to talk about COVID in this episode. It's a context that's in the back of my mind for this whole discussion, not least because I think it's one of the reasons, or it's among the reasons that, you know, critical disability studies and crip theory is finally getting its place in the sun, partly because we're about to have a lot more people with chronic disabilities, you know.
Absolutely. Let me transition into it with something else. So that's art and eugenics and quote unquote sickness. And then there's also this long history of film engaging with disabled bodies and eugenic ideas. There's this film called The Black Stork that's been really brilliantly written about by Martin S. Pernick that is explicitly stating some of the ideas that I think are latent in old, which is that disabled bodies are expendable and can be used for utilitarian medical purposes. It's a eugenicist film. So Harry Hazelden played himself as a doctor, wrote it, and it was based on true stories where he was really embodying and advertising the American sensibility about eugenic practice, where he would, either with parents' knowledge or without parents' knowledge, withhold treatment from babies born with certain conditions and let them die.
Wait, in the film or...?
Both in the film and in real life. And so parents started, the film was almost like advertisement where parents were coming before and after the film were coming to Hazelden to get assisted dying for their children with disabilities.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But in the film, the mother is torn about whether she wants to let Hazelden let her baby die or not. And then in the film, she has this vision where she sees what the child's life would be like with the disability, which is, you know, of course, the whole argument of eugenics is that, okay, the child's life would not be worth living and it would be a burden on society. And in this vision that the mother has with Hazelden, the doctor, is that the child is going to have a lot of pain, both social and physical, descend into madness and then crime. And so the mother allows Hazelden to allow her baby to die. And then you see the baby's soul leap into the arms of Jesus.
I literally hate the early 20th century so much.
One of the other big narratives of old is the big fucking twist at the end, which you said, not really a big twist. I thought it was, but maybe I'm gullible. But that this whole film is about medical testing and medical experimentation, which of course, once again, relates back to the Nazis and their practices. But I think that the film allows us to think about these histories and the visual representation of these histories in a really interesting way. So I'll go full history of medicine nerd, but do you want to explain what happens with this twist?
Yeah, sure. So during that time on the beach, the boy sees a gleam on the top of the hill and is like, that's a camera, which like, how do you know that? Anyway, and that's our first hint because he's like, that's a camera. You're like, okay, they're being watched. So what ends up happening is the two kids escape in like the most ridiculous way imaginable. No one knows that they've escaped. So I think it's M. Night Shyamalan who's manning the camera that's watching all of them. So he thinks everyone is now dead. And so we cut to this like very like glinting, beautiful, pristine medical laboratory where everyone's in lab coats. And this man is like, oh, you know, we're so, you rewatched it, so you'll know exactly what he said. But, you know, he's like their ringleader and he's like, pour one out for our homies who, you know, gave their lives to medicine.
Experiment number 73.
they're like, oh yeah, these subjects sacrifice their lives for the greater good. And then he explicitly spells out for us that because of the advanced temporal properties of this island, it means that they can study like degenerative disease and stuff. There's a specific quote. Do you know what it is? He's like, in the time span of a day, what would take generations or something, like,
yeah, or like a whole lifetime. It would take us a whole study of a whole lifetime and we can do it in a day.
He might as well explicitly say the ends justify the means.
But also key to this is that the cocktails that they got at the beginning from the waitress had drugs in them that were supposed to help their conditions, that then these drugs either helped them over the prolonged time at the beach or didn't. And that's how they rapidly tested their drugs. But so this idea of medical testing, non-consensual medical testing and medical experimentation is a subject that's rife for horror.
Yeah.
And always has been. There's an oral tradition in the late 19th and early 20th century. A lot of this history that I'm going to be talking about is very America-centric, because even though like the accents in this film are European, the big pharma narrative of this big twist is very American.
His bit is very like American blockbuster. Like,
exactly. But so there was a black oral tradition in the late 19th, early 20th century about night doctors, who were these villains who would abduct you and test you, and like these doctors who would do things to your body without your consent. Within medical ethics, like big principles of medical ethics are autonomy, so patient autonomy, non-maleficence, beneficence, and justice. And like the idea with utilitarian medical experimentation is that the thing that can go by the wayside in crisis or for the greater good is that the individual's patient autonomy becomes less important, because the moral obligation is to the wider public. And that's what's happening in Old, is that the death of these people with disabilities and their families. And it's interesting that what they do in the reveal is that like there's one scientist who's like coded as like the good criminal or whatever, who's like, oh, but don't you think we should try again to apply to the pharmaceutical company to maybe not kill the able-bodied people, is basically what he says.
Yikes.
Which of course, once again, adds to the eugenicist undertone of this film.
Well, and one thing I want to say, this makes me think of a few things that sort of tie together. One is disability studies is really profound emphasis on individual experience and how much at odds that sits with this sort of utilitarian thing that you're proposing, right? If the big bit of the utilitarian thing is we can sacrifice individuals for the greater good, what so much of like critical disability theory, CRIP studies, disability activism, actually, in fact, beyond the academy, is saying each body has different needs. Each body mind is referred to in these subfields, you know, emphasizing the interconnectivity, the inextricability of one's mind and one's body. And linked to this is this idea of CRIP time, which I thought about a lot when I was prepping for this episode, because of course, time is the theme, you know, time and aging, aging and time, that's the theme of the film. And CRIP time is basically the idea for the fact that people with disabilities experience time in a different way to able-bodied people. And there's actually a really moving essay that I read by Ellen Samuels called Six Ways of Looking at CRIP Time. In this essay, the sort of summation of CRIP time is, quoting Alison Kafer, rather than bend disabled bodies and minds to meet the clock, CRIP time bends the clock to meet disabled bodies and minds. So it's this idea that, you know, if you're dealing with chronic fatigue, if you're dealing with a lot of these other things, you are just operating in a different time scale than that of sort of like late capitalism, the 9 to 5, this world we're all structured in. And like, I didn't know if I was going to go here for this episode, but as you know, I've been dealing with something I think is long COVID for 3 and a bit months at this point. That's basically just, you know, the symptoms of like chronic fatigue, a bit of brain fog, a lot of short of breathness. And the way that the rhythms of your life change, like, and how at odds that sits with obviously academic culture, which of course the wonderful Travis Chiwing Lau, I don't know if you follow him on Twitter, but he's amazing. I do.
He is really amazing. His work is amazing.
But it's something he's written about, is like the being in the academy, academia's like hyper-productive ethos of like working yourself to the bone. And I was really touched by what Samuels wrote in this essay, because there's this focus on both the grief that comes with it and the opportunity for new ways of engaging with the world, the opportunity and the gift of sort of being back into taking your individual body on its own terms and your the needs of your body-mind on its own terms, even when those won't bend to article deadlines, in-person meetings, whatever the thing might be.
I think that's perfect. The idea of crip time is so interesting with this movie, with Old. First of all, actually, one thing I wanted to say is, so the essay, the review of Old that I talked about before that the White Pube wrote, she, you know, has chronic illness because of long COVID as well.
Yeah.
So that context of long COVID as disabling is embedded in some of the earlier stuff that we talked about. And so this idea of crip time being out of the capitalist world. So like in Old, M. Night Shyamalan is making these people with these chronic illnesses bend to capitalist American timeframes to the nth degree. Like it becomes even more extreme because they are being put into this experiment by Big Pharma. One of the most, Big Pharma as like American capitalism, extreme. Mm. It's like making sure that crip time can't happen in any way.
The individuals not only have no autonomy over their bodies or their choice to be in this experiment, in this place, they can't leave even when they try to leave. Yeah, I don't know if I want to. Yeah, I was going to make an analogy to a concentration camp, but that's a bit intense. But it is really like, you know, yeah. They're being, what I can say is it does put one in mind, whether intentionally or not. I don't know if it was to be intentional, there could have been more emphasis on people who live at odd angles to society, like queer people and people of color. But the links to the Nazis and their famous medical and obviously non-consensual medical experimentation on the Jews and the queer people and the people of color and the communists who were in the concentration camps, like it's, yeah.
Of course. And that links really perfectly to the history of medical experimentation, because of course, if I say medical experimentation to you or to anybody, really, first thought is concentration camps,
yeah,
Nazis, etc. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about like the history of this practice. And Susan Lederer, in her book, Subjected to Science, argues this, that there's a blind spot in a lot of modern histories, or she wrote this in the 90s. So at that point, there'd been a blind spot in a lot of modern histories of human medical experimentation, where the narrative was that these experiments started during the Second World War and then were exposed by the Nuremberg trials.
Yeah.
And then were fixed by the Nuremberg Code of 1946, which meant that patients had to have voluntary consent for any medical experimentations on their bodies, right? So Susan Lederer's book is about human experimentation before World War II. She talks a lot about all these pre-World War II examples to show that like this was embedded, especially in American culture, non-consensual, especially on people who were marginalized in various ways. Either they were, you know, the phrase then was quote unquote feeble-minded or institutionalized or children or babies or Black, you know, that this was a long history. It wasn't just the Nazis, right?
Yeah.
This is what we've been talking about a bit. But so like there were tons of examples of experimental medicine happening in hospitals. A doctor who realized that he couldn't save the life of this quote unquote feeble-minded woman named Mary Rafferty. He was then like, well, I might as well do some experiments with electrodes to her brain.
Ugh.
This then was condemned by the American Medical Association, which shows there were ethical pushbacks against this type of work. It was the injury that was sustained by the electrodes to Mary Rafferty's brain that were problematic. It was against the Hippocratic idea of doing no harm. And then people like Claude Bernard in his 1865 Introduction to the Study of Experimental Medicine, you know, he brought up the question of medical and surgical morality, even though the result might be wholly advantageous to science, to the health of others. The principle of medical morality and surgical morality meant that you could not perform experiments on people that might harm them in any way.
Something that's interesting there for me, and it came up a lot. It's sort of an open question for me as I was reading some of this stuff in preparation for this episode, is also this idea of, I don't know what you said, like, but for the greater good of future humankind, this emphasis on futurity, or even the idea that people would want to live. It's, you know, it's once again, the ideology of ability, right? This idea that the ideal body is one that can live for 100 years. Anti-disability rhetoric and practice is so ingrained in our culture and day-to-day life that it's almost, you know, this kind of thing that we never even stop to ask ourselves. It's like, why would you want to live forever? Like, so even this idea that it might be for the greater good, it's like, of whom? And, you know, it's this wild.
Yeah. And it's so interesting that you said that, because like the thing I just quoted about like there are people bringing up the moral implications of medical experimentation, but it started to swing the other way in the 1930s when this idea of medical progress and, you know, doctors became like such a noble profession, it swung the other way to like where experimentation was medical progress. And so the American public started to just really be positive towards these kinds of things and be more utilitarian and for the greater good and for the future, et cetera. There's this one piece called An Honest Doctor. It's actually from 1916, but like the ideas relate to the 1930s and what was going on then, because it shows this idea of the majority versus the minority and the privileged majority and the privileged public, American public versus the marginalized minority with disabilities, and like how there's such a disconnect where like disability is something that happens to other people.
Yeah.
Whereas aging is something that happens to everyone. But so in An Honest Doctor, he writes, quote, "If it is true that the progress of medicine has been over a mountain of corpses, one objects to its being one's own corpse. If it is also true that in medicine, nothing risked, nothing gained, one prefers to have the gain to humanity made at the expense of someone else." And so the easy scapegoat here is, of course, people with chronic illnesses. And the easy scapegoat in old is the people with disabilities with chronic illnesses, and right?
Where old fails to really make that critique like sharp and turn is the fact that, as you've sort of, I think, tangentially mentioned, but as we've definitely discussed before, who are the others that end up being used for testing? And like, as we saw with COVID, it's like the global south where we just let it fucking happen and like see what happens. Yeah. Or, you know, the history of gynecology, which was the famous non-consensual testing of black women without anesthesia or
We're made to see very clearly the reasoning for this medical experimentation in old, because they say this drug on the epileptic woman, the therapist that we were talking about, the black therapist, she didn't have a seizure until the very, very end. And so they're like, this drug worked. We're going to cure epilepsy. This is the net good. That's a net good. And they were like, we're going to save X number of people from epileptic seizures.
But also to what I was saying earlier, save X number of people from epileptic seizures for a certain amount of time. You know, there's this like always pushing forward, passing the buck on, rather than making our world more accessible to people, like, I don't know, who may choose to want to live in certain ways.
Oh, right. And so the question also within old and within this wider history of medical experimentation is who is making these decisions?
Yeah.
Right. Same with COVID. And so David Rothman's book, Strangers at the Bedside, talks about the shift in the 1960s. The big shift happened between like 1966 and 1976, where it was no longer the individual physician's prerogative to make these outright decisions about who lived, who died, who got treatment, who didn't, et cetera. And that relates to medical experimentation and, non-consensual testing, right? So thinking about this like unilateral decision-making, it really feels like even though there's so many people in the room in this lab in the movie Old, it is like a very top-down, not ethically sanctioned doctor-patient relationship. Like where it really goes back to pre-1960s type of decision-making with these types of things.
And then once again, it fails to make the stronger critique, right? So instead of making it like a government-sanctioned, which is happening all the time, as we've just discussed with COVID, or like various different things, like ethical malpractice by these pharmaceutical giants is like a known fact of our time. Exactly. And so they put it back on individuals instead of critiquing the structure underlying it, which once again is why I think it's bad horror. Because like really my takeaway, I work a lot on horror. I'm working increasingly on horror and thinking a lot about what it is that is scary about the disabled body. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I mean that like as in as it's given to us by horror films. Yeah. And just thinking about how the physical disability, I feel like, is something that stands in for us for the body we can't read, you know, and like can't.
Which once again maps onto modern art.
Yeah.
A lot of people saying, oh, this doesn't make any sense. I can't read this. Like, this isn't representational.
Yeah. People with disability are so distanced from what is considered normal and are so encouraged to bend their bodies, lives, and presentation into forms that might not be fit for them, that they might not want, you know.
Right.
That it's turned people with disabilities into, like, a deflective shield that we are told we can't read. Like, and they're there to be pitied or, you know, well, really pitied, frankly, no matter what feared.
Yeah, and made into monsters.
And the flip side of that, or the other part, is, you know, people with cognitive or psychological disabilities being the person who we can't read socially, or whose mind we can't read, who's irrational or who's unpredictable. And the way that all of those tropes of like our deepest fears about not being able to understand one another, of people acting in ways we don't expect, just get sloppily mapped onto this sort of social construction of disability.
Yeah. No, and yeah, and the cognitive is represented in Charles and the physical is represented in Crystal. And they're like this, just even just looking at those two characters in Old really like points out not only the flaws in the film, but the flaws in society and culture in general. And like, that's exactly what disability studies is trying to push against.
I feel like that's a good place to end. I'm going to go watch The Visit now, which is Shyamalan's horror.
I know. I feel like I now want to watch Unbreakable really badly.
You really should. It would make a fascinating double feature with Old.
Thank you so much for listening to us talk about M. Night Shyamalan's 2021 film, Old. We really, really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you guys enjoyed listening to it. We'd like to shout out our audio producer, C.S. Merkling, as well as the Association for Art History, which in part funded this season of Drawing Blood. As always, you know, rate, subscribe, etc. Show us some love on Twitter. Let us know if your Spotify Wrapped included Drawing Blood. And yeah, once again, thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it. Bye.